Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. Tonight, for our audience here live and also for our audiences online and on the radio, we are going to be speaking about the book Kindred Beings by Sherry Speed and her work in Africa with chimpanzees. As part of the Monday Night Philosophy series, we're going to first tell the story a little bit about what the work has done, and I will interview her about this. And then we're going to go into different ideas that this impacts in philosophy on what the work with chimpanzees gives her a perspective. It's a very interesting book. Gives her a perspective on certain issues that we've been arguing about for a very long time. And we'll go into that soon. But now, Sherry Speed.
Thank you.
So, Sherry. I think we should start by you telling a little bit of a story about you were a veterinarian and then you were kind of induced or inspired to give up your practice or at least walk away from your practice for a while and go to Africa and do this work with chimpanzees. And you started from scratch. It's a fascinating story how you did it. I'm sure everybody would like to hear a little bit about that.
Yes, I was practicing veterinary medicine in Portland, Oregon. I was a one-third owner of a veterinary practice there. And I really enjoyed my work with the animals and the people who love them. But after doing it for about 10 years, I started, I was thirsty for challenge and just something different. And I really wanted to advocate for animals in a bigger way. And I had heard about Dr. Elliot Katz with an organization called In Defense of Animals based here in the Bay Area. And he hired me as the Northwest Director. And I opened the Northwest Office of In Defense of Animals in Portland. And in that capacity, I met people and then went to I was doing some veterinary work for animals in sanctuaries, including primates. And I went to Africa and worked with chimpanzees and gorillas for the first time in the country of Cameroon. And I went in January of 1997 and then went back later the same year. And I met some chimpanzees who were orphans of the meat trade. It's an illegal trade. These endangered species, chimpanzees, gorillas, and other species of primates, and lots of other species. And I met some orphans who their mothers had been killed when they were babies by hunters supplying the meat trade, and then they had languished in cages and on chains for decades. And I really got, I befriended them, and after that I just could not come back to my comfortable life in the United States and forget about them. I'm an activist at heart, and I became really connected to the conservation cause. I really wanted to go over there and take care of this bushmeat thing once and for all. And so I had the idea that I was going to start a small sanctuary in the forest, take my friends, these adult captive chimps who had no other option for ever having a better life. I was going to circle some tracts of forest and take them back to natural habitat. And it was going to be just a small little project, and that part of it was. And then I was going to work as an activist for conservation. I didn't have a very good understanding, though, about the scope of the problem with orphans in Central Africa, because as soon as I had an infrastructure set up, orphans kept coming and coming and coming. And whereas I had started off with adults, soon I had an influx of babies, and I was working with the government of Cameroon, and then ultimately they were confiscating babies that I was then taking. And we actually enabled them to enforce their own laws, which had been in place since 1994, but they didn't have a way to enforce them because they didn't have a place for the orphans. So that's how it got started.
Is that loud enough? All right. I think you could tell a little story about Jackie and Pepe and Becky and how you met them, and these are chimpanzees, and how you what condition you found them in, and then I love the story about the ride within the cages to the first inmates for your sanctuary.
Well, I in the town of Limbe there were three chimps in small cages that had been brought there as tourist attractions. And one, the older male, had been there for over 30 years in a small cage, and he had really just gone crazy. They called him the mad chimpanzee of Limbe, and I describe in my book the different forms of stereotypy and neurotic behavior that he had. But it was very sad. He was very dangerous. People who went close to his cage had been injured. And then there were two other chimpanzees who were younger, and they were more approachable, and they had been there for a long time too. We didn't really know how long, but over 10 years. And I befriended the two who were approachable, Pepe and Becky. And Jackie, I felt a deep compassion and sympathy for him, and wondered if we were to take him back to the forest, if he might recover. And people told me that there was no chance, that, you know, he should just be euthanized, that the chimp could never be socialized, he could never recover after what he had been through. And ultimately, I wanted to give him a chance. And I worked with, in the early days, I worked with a friend of mine who was there for a couple of years, who spoke French. I didn't speak any French, and it's a French-speaking country. So we set up the sanctuary, and it was a long process with lots of obstacles and problems along the way, but ultimately we did set up the sanctuary and then took the three there. They were our first residents. And the incident George was describing is when we actually took them in a minivan, and I took out the seats of the minivan to make room for these three cages. And the rainy season, I had been racing to build the structure before the rain set in and made the roads impassable so that we could take a big truck. But by the time we actually got the facility ready to bring them there, the rains had already come, and so it was very difficult. We couldn't rent a big truck, and so we had to squeeze these cages into the minivan. And against all advice that I shouldn't do it, I insisted on that, you know, every minute did matter, and we couldn't wait until the dry season, and we had to go through, and there were other chimps who were waiting besides these three. So we took them, and we did indeed get stuck on the road and had to push our way out with three screaming chimps in the cages inside. But we ultimately did make it. And I have some pictures, but I don't know. Is it okay to do that with the radio?
Yeah.
Okay. This is just myself and my staff, my manager, the French woman who's worked with me for 10 years there at a sign at our sanctuary there. And some people don't know where Cameroon is. I was just going to show it's where Africa gets skinny there. They call it the armpit of Africa. My pointer isn't working, or I would have showed you. Okay, we're located in the Embargé Forest, and this is a helicopter view of the sanctuary, and this is the camp. And then the tracts of forest that I've encircled are surrounding the camp, and they extend out farther than you can see with this view. And this is Jackie when I first met him, the mad chimpanzee. Yeah, it was a sad life he had, but this is him a couple of years ago at Sanagayan. Yeah. And Becky and Pepe were the other two, and I don't actually have a picture of them here, but they're no longer with us. But they did have some years at the sanctuary. And this is Nama, another chimpanzee, who she had been on this short 5-foot chain for 16 years at an amusement park. And it was a hotel, really, more than an amusement park. And she, there was another chimpanzee there named Dorothy. And Dorothy, there was a photo of the funeral of Dorothy that went viral back in 2009. And that picture is the whole reason, the attention that picture got internationally is what inspired me to write the book in the first place, because it was the chimpanzees mourning Dorothy. And I thought, well, if people were as touched as they were by this simple expression of grief in the chimpanzees, maybe they were ready to hear and were able to understand that, you know, among us animals, there really is an evolutionary continuum. So that's why I wrote the book. And Nama and Dorothy, they were, whereas the first three chimps, it was easy because I reached an agreement with the owners of the hotel to take these chimps. This one was taken without consent, and the government went in and confiscated these chimpanzees and eight primates and two parrots, and it was the first ever armed confiscation of animals in the country of Cameroon. We had seven military police and went in. It was a very dramatic confiscation. And Nama went on to become the alpha female at the sanctuary to Jackie's alpha male. And between Jackie, who showed an absolutely remarkable capacity to recover, and I think his story is absolutely phenomenal, and Nama also was, even though she was much smaller than many of the other adults, she has a lion heart, because she was so strong, and she became the alpha female of the group. And together she and Jackie ruled for 10 years, and they allowed us to, that's the two of them embracing, and they allowed us to extend this group to 26 chimps that they ruled. And now we have 7 different groups of chimpanzees with different leaders. And of the first 5 chimpanzees that I've mentioned, Jackie is the only one who survives, and he's no longer the leader of that group. He's enjoying a nice retirement, though. And I have a video, just a short video of a few years ago when he was still the leader, and Nama and the other the first chimpanzees were still there. And I just wanted to show you. This is them coming out in the morning, and they like to. This enclosure is 20 acres, and they enjoy making the rounds of the enclosure. And I would follow along on the outside of the enclosure. And this is Jackie, the big guy there.
I was going to ask you about the seizure, because I thought that showed your determination tremendously in the book. It's enough to get all the money together and to build these cages and to get the land and stuff like that. But you actually got the government military to side with you against one of the leading families of Cameroon because of the animals. That takes persuasive powers that are just not very common. I wanted you to tell a little bit about that what you had to go through in order to persuade them against their own personal interest, basically, to enforce a law that no one had ever enforced.
Well, and this, I think, honestly, in this particular situation, the stars lined up for us, because this family had refused to accommodate the government by paying a permit fee, and the delegate with the Ministry of Forestry and Wildlife had was willing to grandfather in the chimpanzees that they had. As well as and there were actually no laws against holding the monkeys because they weren't endangered species, and the government just wanted them to pay these fees, and the family thought that they were powerful enough that they didn't need to do that, and so they had thumbed their nose at the law for a few years. And so when I went to the Cameroon government and talked to them about this, you know, again, the stars kind of lined up, because they were angry at that point and felt disrespected by the family that they had not paid the permits. And so, but they did say, when I first went, I went and asked about confiscating the chimpanzees. And they said, well, we're willing to confiscate the chimpanzees, but we can't go in and enforce the law halfway. If we confiscate the chimpanzees, we have to confiscate everybody. And so I worked with some colleagues of mine, and we found placement for the monkeys as well. So we were able to go in and confiscate the chimpanzees and the monkeys. And then as we were leaving, we noticed these two parrots that didn't have feathers in a small cage, and my friend Estelle, who had been helping, came to me and said, can we take the parrots? And I said, I don't know, ask Mr. Essie if we can take the parrots. And she asked him, and he said, yeah, they don't have permits for the parrots, get the parrots. So we ended up driving away with everybody in 7 vehicles, and as we were driving out of the driveway, they had called the patriarch of the family, and he had shown up and turned his vehicle sideways in the driveway and said, you're not taking my animals. And basically, after some drama, they removed the driver from the car, and we were able to drive around his car and get away.
I don't know if any of you have any experience working in Africa, but this is an extremely impressive achievement. There's a few of the stories of the background. And now, you know, for the series, I think there's a lot of interesting ideas. And the one idea I want to talk about is empathy. Clearly, you have to be a very empathic person to feel this for chimpanzees, to go out and do it. But one of the things I found very interesting in your book was your difficult decisions of where to draw the line. You just mentioned one, the monkeys. You didn't know whether you were going to take the monkeys or not. And The reason you gave in the book is because they weren't legally protected, because there's too many monkeys, they're not endangered. But you also make other decisions about, I'm going to help the chimpanzees, and you clearly devoted yourself to the chimpanzees versus other things. And how did you come to those decisions?
I think that I certainly felt more empathy for the chimpanzees because we are more like one another than either of us are to any other animal on the planet. But there are so many problems in Africa, both with so much poverty, so much suffering with among the humans and among the animals. And we've done a lot to help the people and the community around us. But at some point, I realized that if I was going to do what I wanted to do for chimpanzees, I had to keep my eye on that prize. And it would be too easy to get distracted in different directions. And so I pretty much have done that and focused my attention on chimpanzees and gorillas to an extent. I didn't write about that, but we've done confiscated or helped with confiscation of gorillas as well. But I do write in the book that regarding this monkey issue, it seemed such an insurmountable thing to even take the chimpanzees, these two chimpanzees, and that was my focus. I didn't think there was any possibility of getting the monkeys, and I felt very guilty about doing that. I knew it was wrong to leave them, and I told myself that one day we might be able to come back, but right now we just had to get the chimps. And then when the possibility did present itself that we can take everybody, you know, I felt really deeply ashamed that I was willing to leave them there and just take the chimpanzees. And in that incident, we got to take everybody. But there are other incidents where I have focused primarily on my chimp rescue.
One of the things that came up in the book, which I thought, again, was very honestly presented, was you were obviously, although trained as a veterinarian, you were obviously the best medical person in how many miles? 50 miles or 50 miles, something
at
like
least.
And therefore, the local villagers would come to you for problems. And at one point, you write that so many were coming that it was taking away your time from the chimpanzees. And I think this is a very difficult situation. And so one of the questions I'd have, I mean, you weren't inspired by that, but if you had been a medical doctor, would you have gone and spent 10 years, you know, at a village in Africa as a doctor? And that choice of empathy is very interesting to me. So if you want to talk about that, that's...
Well, I think that I am a veterinarian, mm-hmm. and, you know, for a reason. I chose to be a veterinarian and not to be a human doctor. And then ultimately it's interesting that I was pulled back to the animal that's most like us, which, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not sure why I made that circle, but... you know, I do feel compassion for the humans, and we've saved hundreds of lives in the human community by providing medical care. And the woman who works with me, she didn't have a medical background, but she's learned, and we've provided. She still, in my absence, is saving lives every day. So we do a lot, but sometimes it's with some resentment that it's taking me away from what my mission is and what I really want to do. Because I feel compassion for everything, including the humans, my passion is toward conservation of chimpanzees. And I think really people say, oh, how can you spend so much time saving chimpanzees or saving animals when there's so many humans who need help? And I think if that's really such an anthropocentric way of looking at it, because if we were really looking at it objectively as like some alien species looking down, who would it be more important to help, a species that's about to disappear or a species that's overgrowing the petri dish with 7 billion of us and growing and driving everything else off the planet? So I don't think it's an irrational choice, but it was an emotional choice of mine.
Yeah, and you brought up aliens, which was my next question, actually. Because it seems to me that one of the fascinating things about the whole idea of animals and our relationship to other species is that we often talk about aliens in two different ways. One, we want to meet them so that we can have a connection to another species, even though we have all these intelligent species on our own planet that we really don't connect. That's one part of our relationship with them. The other part of the relationship I find interesting is that, at least as expressed by Hollywood in our nightmare scenario, is that the aliens come and basically snack on us. And I think part of what your work with the chimpanzees seems to me that they're being eaten.
Yeah.
And is that part of the motivating force, that they're being eaten, or?
I think that question is interesting, and I think part of it is the injustice. Mm-hmm. And there's the a part of me, the activist in me, wants to right a wrong that's being done, and I can't stand cruelty to humans or to animals, but there is such an injustice, and that these chimpanzees, who are so like us in so many ways, and they're not, I don't want to romanticize chimpanzees, because humans, for instance, I think we have the best on the planet in terms of characteristics, where we can be loving and nurturing and so compassionate, and we have the worst. You know, we can be such a cruel species, and chimpanzees have that same spectrum. They are so like us in so many ways. I'm sorry, I forgot your question.
No, that's right. That was perfect.
Excuse me.
No, I think that's, you know, in your book you are so honest about this too. You know, a lot of people who advocate for something try to whitewash it a little bit, but you made it very clear how the chimpanzees behave, and that it was totally admirable that that's what they are. They're chimpanzees, and they're going to behave like that. It's another element of the human-animal relationship is that we often admire, like, tigers, eagles, and the behavior that we admire in these top predators is that they get their way in the world. They take their way and they get their way, and we kind of admire their freedom. But if any human beings behaved like that, we would lock them up. And I find that a very interesting dichotomy. And I don't know if you'd like to talk about that.
Well, I think it's interesting too. It's when a lot, you know, chimpanzees are wild animals, and they should be living free as a people, self-determining as we are. And if they're left alone in the forest, they don't cause problems with humans. Mm. It's when they're taken captive and we become part of their social world in an abusive, exploitative way that they cause, you know, atrocities. And I think when a lion or a tiger attacks someone, we almost expect it and excuse it. Oh, well, it's a wild animal, of course. But when a chimpanzee does it, I wonder, you know, we see it as an atrocity, and everybody's shocked. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's, you know, that certainly they've caused some severe injuries that have been publicized a lot. But I wonder if it's because we see ourselves in them that it becomes more shocking.
Mm-hmm. That's a great observation, because we don't really have a very logical perspective on the animals at all. So maybe we can switch to another big idea, which you know, you kind of take for granted as your switch to being a vegetarian over a period of time. Now, we don't have to talk about the basics. This is San Francisco, you know, so there's plenty of vegetarians. But I think one question about that is, if you project it out to the future, this isn't going to happen, but just say that the vast majority of human beings, maybe because of the lack of other food and so on and so forth, or the number of human beings going to 15 billion and therefore we have to switch the way we eat, if the vast majority of human beings switch to a vegetarian diet, what do you think that would do to the rest of the large mammals on the planet? Would that be an advantage or a disadvantage?
Well, I think if they, in terms of the animals who are being hunted to extinction, like chimpanzees, it would be a really strong advantage.
Right.
I think to the in terms of, you know, the cows who are being farmed with intensive farming practices, it can only be good for them to end that suffering, and also for the environment, because it's very the farming practices today are very environmentally damaging, and you know that's damaging to the environment in many ways. As a vegetarian, I do want to say something about that though, because I've changed in my thinking about that over the years, because we are animals, just like chimpanzees are animals, just like the carnivores are animals. So I don't really think anymore that people in the African villages eat animals and it causes suffering. But I do not think that it's morally wrong, because they are animals just like chimpanzees and just like other animals are animals. It is not morally wrong for them to eat animals. And so I don't think for people not being vegetarians that I'm to tell them you're doing something wrong. But I do think that we are a species because of our big cerebral cortexes, and we are a species who are able to recognize the suffering that our choices cause, and we can make a choice to not cause that, to walk gently on the planet and to not cause suffering. And I think that while it may not be immoral to eat animals, because we are all animals, I think it's virtuous to make compassionate choices that don't cause suffering.
Great way of putting it. Great way. Now, to kind of combine the two of the approach to other animals and the empathy. We have empathy for certain animals. I always found it interesting, for example, that people cared a lot about dolphins, you know, and making sure that they don't get caught in nets, But nobody really says that the tuna shouldn't be caught that you know, you're making the nets for. And so we make a distinction. As you said, we feel closer to the dolphins. They're mammals. They seem to be more intelligent. We seem to be able to communicate with them. And you mentioned a story about an alligator or a crocodile that's tied up in a thing. And you mentioned, well, it has a small brain. Maybe it can't feel the suffering. I don't really know. You're exploring these issues in a very interesting way in a book about your advocacy of animals. You still explore all those difficult issues. I find it very fascinating because it's not common. And you mentioned earlier about the chimpanzees. People are shocked about them. I think partially that's due to the fact that the first images that were brought out to us from Africa were that they were these gentle, you know, almost like, and the gorillas too, this peaceful people we should all be. But it turned out that's not really true.
Yeah. Well, and I think that Jane Goodall in the beginning, I mean, she's the one who first brought chimpanzees to the world. And she, at first she thought, I've heard in an interview her say that she thought that they were like humans, only nicer. Mm-hmm. And then the more she observed, she realized that, no, they're just like humans. So I think maybe our misconceptions came partly from those early days.
The early days, yeah. It's always hope. Hope always trumps reality at the start. But, you know, the other stories you mentioned and so on, but there's not much compassion, and I don't think that almost any empathy can be created in human beings for mosquitoes. Or for the ants, the fire ants or something. Even though those are the dominant, you know, biomass on our planet, insects are, we don't have much feeling for that. And I don't know if you want to talk about that. I mean, I know the Buddhist thought wants to take it all the way, but how do you feel about that? You said a little bit about it. I think a little bit more would be great.
Well, I think that there are people. I mean, I know people who wouldn't kill ants, who... you know, I don't know if they would kill fleas and mosquitoes. I would like to see them in Africa not kill a mosquito. But but I do know that there are people who would really avoid any unnecessary killing, and even including myself. But if I'm under attack, you know, by ants or mosquitoes, then I'm going to defend myself. And, you know, I think that's what it is. And I, you know, if I, even today, after I have a story about the carnivorous ants and my bad experiences with them, in fact, heartbreaking experiences. But if I pass a, you know, a row of ants and I have the choice, I step over, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, that's great. I think one of the things for vegetarians, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, is the biological knowledge that we now have about how our body operates. And we also know that there are all kinds of animals that are extremely small that we didn't know were around in mm-hmm. our animals, like bacteria. And, you know, our bodies, without our ability to stop it, kill millions of those animals every day. So there's really no way around this, and I think it's, as a result of that knowledge, I think it would be very interesting to get a shift. And your book has a lot of ideas in it, which is why I wanted to go into it. There's got to be a shift in idea about this, and I think you kind of say what it is. It's the intentionality of how you approach it. For what reason you do it, and if you're under attack, that's a different thing. You bring in the self-defense. Very fascinating. And so I want to go to another really big philosophical issue, which is free will. So in your book, it's very clear you believe that the animals have free will, and basically you want to bring them back to a chance to use their free will, because these were, you know, animals that were caged for decades and didn't really have a chance to do almost anything they wanted to for a long time. And how you set it up and how carefully you put the two groups together and everything so that they could have a possibility, I'd love you to talk about that a little bit, the free will.
Well, I think that chimpanzees are, I mean, they are wild animals. When they are free living, they are self-determining, and they form their own communities, their own societies, and they have their own culture, and they make it just fine without people. They make their choices. They collaborate for hunting. They make war on one another. They can be cruel. They can be kind and loving. You know, they have very, very supportive family groups, and then they have, you know, they don't get along sometimes, and they're very cruel to one another within the same social group. So, but they are self-determining, and as a people, and that is what they should be. And you know, there's certainly no doubt that they have things that they want for themselves. They have desires. I see it all the time. I have just to give you a just the last, I was in Cameroon for 3 months. I just came back, and one of our chimpanzees has, we have these electric enclosures, which unfortunately you didn't get to see in that video, but we have these electric enclosures that circle big tracts of forest, and the chimpanzees live inside. And there's reasons they need to be kept separate. And just really quickly, chimpanzees who are free living, they leave people alone. We're an insignificant species. We're tall, for all they know. We're stronger than them. There's just no point in making problems with us. So they avoid us. Once you take a chimpanzee captive, we have become a part of their social world. And they quickly learn. By the time they're three, they're stronger than me. So they know that that they're stronger. And they, you know, they can't, they're a danger to people. And not only in our part of Africa, because they're not afraid of people, they're in danger from people too. We have an illegal hunting trade. So we have to keep them in these protected enclosures. And it protects the people and it protects the chimps. But anyway, we had, when I was just back there, a chimpanzee named Ginger. I saw him with my own eyes. We have these enclosures with insulators that wires pass through. And he came from the forest with a big stick. And he worked to break the bottom of the insulators, the bottom two insulators of the enclosure. And then he took the same stick to lift up the bottom of the enclosure and then encouraged another male to go out. And the other male went out. And then he tried to get another one to go, and the other one didn't want to go. But Charlo got out and wreaked a little havoc in the camp, and we got him back in. He just recently, after I left, he did the same thing again. And so Agnes and I were talking about, you know, he doesn't like Charlo. He wants Charlo to go out of the group. But that's the only reason we can think of it, or other than that he's just bored. And we've done some things to, and that is, I will say, we do a lot, you know, they have these big tracts of forest that, so they have rich physical environments, but they also need rich social environments. And so we try to have big social groups. And if the groups are small, maybe it's not as rich enough to make them want to stay inside.
Well, thank you very much for going into those ideas. And I'd like to go back to the story again. You tell wonderful stories about Dorothy, the chimp that was the subject of that famous picture in the National Geographic. And what I thought was very interesting was the way you described her when she first was brought to the sanctuary. That is, she had been caged for 40 years or so and was socially awkward. The other ones had been caged too, but she was socially awkward, as if she was the wallflower in your high school class or something like that. And that she then found herself by adopting a baby chimp and becoming an adoptive mother in her 40s. It was a very touching story, and I'd love you to share it a little bit.
Okay, Dorothy was an older female chimpanzee who was on a chain with Nama. She was at the same hotel, and she had been there we had confirmed 25 years, and I later came to believe she'd been there 40 years, that we found other evidence. But she really, and she never in her life climbed trees. She was always on the ground after being on the chain for that much time. But when we brought her there, at first she came under attack from a male chimpanzee who wanted to use her as a scapegoat to show that he was powerful in the group. He was trying to ascend socially. And Nama then first asserted herself to protect Dorothy, and that's how she established the alliance with Jackie, and he rose to power in the group. But after that, there was a female in the group that just really antagonized Dorothy socially. I mean, she would pour water on her head and spit on her and hit her with a stick, although Nama didn't let her do that but one time. But Dorothy really struggled to find her place. And whereas the other chimps were off in the forest and, you know, establishing these strong relationships, Dorothy often sat on the outskirts of the forest by herself. And then we introduced a group of six babies. And there was a little boy in the group named Babul who was 4 years old. And he was, of the babies we had, he was a very clingy little boy. We put him in there. And soon after about a month, I noticed that whereas he had always been clinging to his human surrogate mothers, now he was always with Dorothy. And Dorothy was liking it and grooming him and protecting him and kissing him. And soon it was clear that she had adopted him as her son. And whereas she hadn't been able to assert herself to protect herself, she asserted herself to protect her adopted son. And in her doing that, she gained status and respect in the group. And by the time she died, She was loved and respected by everybody in the group. And that's that picture that went viral was of her funeral while I was cradling her head, and the group had gathered at the fence line to view her body. And you can really see the grief in their faces. But that was them getting to that point where they were grieving over her had taken some years, and the initial couple of years were really difficult for Dorothy.
Just, you know, you'd think that some human beings could take advantage of that information and move out of their socially awkward stage. But because I found that fascinating, because it was so clear, you know, you had spent so much time with it. It was so clear that that's what had happened. Well, another thing that you said, which I thought was also extremely honest, was, I don't like them all equally. You basically acted as their, not their mother, but, you know, their caretaker and everything like that. And you said, this one I really like, this chimpanzee I really like, but you know what, I really don't like them all equally. And you didn't even like the son that Dorothy adopted, although you loved her. You said, you know, bad choice of sons, basically. Because he caused a lot of trouble, and so on. So, you know, maybe talk a little bit about that, you know, one of the first mothers to admit that she doesn't like all her children equally.
Well, there's a lot of them. There's 73. And, you know, just like chimpanzees as a species, they have the range of behavior. You know, each individual is, you know, has ranges of behaviors too. And some of them do manifest what I consider bad behavior more than other ones do. And we have Dorothy's son, while he was clingy and sweet and, you know, really benefited from her love, and it really transformed him into this self-confident little boy, he grew into an adolescent that was a little terrorist. And he was really bullied other chimpanzees. And, you know, I didn't find him likable. And we have another chimpanzee, B. Cole, who was about the same age as Babul, and he has now grown to be the alpha male. Babul actually took over that group for a little while, but he didn't last long because he didn't have political support, because not only I didn't like him, nobody else liked him either. and then B. Cole led the group in a coup against Babul and took over. And Babul is a completely different personality. He's kind and gentle and just, and in my book, I ended my book with a story about him not really him enjoying the benefits of power, but wanting to shun the duties, because he didn't really want to mediate conflicts very much. He got involved if he had to, but he's really grown into that role. And if I can I tell one quick story?
Sure.
It was something that happened this past summer while I was there. B. Cole got out of his enclosure after a free living female. We have chimps that come around the enclosure all the time, and normally our chimps want to stay inside. I mean, they have a rich environment inside, and they want to stay with their group. But we had a female who was in swelling, or she was close to ovulating just outside the enclosure. And B. Cole managed to get out of the enclosure going after her. And he fought with a free-living male chimp, and then he was gone for 3 weeks, and I couldn't find him. And I walked and walked and walked and called for miles, and I couldn't find him. And we have hunters coming down, strange hunters coming from the north, and I was afraid he was going to be killed, and I was afraid the free-living chimps would attack him, and couldn't find him. Finally, a farmer about 2 miles away from us as the crow flies across the forest came and said that he had seen B. Cole that morning at 5 o'clock, which he was out night hunting at 5 in the morning, I'm sure. But he had seen B. Cole, and so I went down there with one of my caregivers, and he took me to the spot where he had seen B. Cole. And I called, and B. Cole, he came where I could see him, and I held chimpanzees. There's a greeting of familiarity and respect. It's a panting. And so I held up my arms and called him, and he came into my arms and hugged me so tight, like he was so happy to be found by somebody who loves him. And he outweighs me by a lot. And he is, and you know, took him back to his family, and he's back. He went back out, and that, by the way, that group had gone crazy in his absence. There was chaos and fighting, and he went back, and within a day back outside, he established order again. So he really has grown into as a good leader. And he's very gentle and kind. But I gave you an example of two chimpanzees who were raised together but had very different personalities. And, you know, the same can happen in human communities, of course. We're not all the same. And I do feel equal responsibility to every single chimpanzee in our sanctuary, and I wouldn't do for one that I wouldn't do for another. But, yes, I do admire the personalities of some more than others.
Well, fortunately, there hasn't been any laws saying that we can't discriminate based on personality traits. That's not come yet.
Oh, and I will just say that Babul, now that he actually is maturing into a nicer adult.
That's good. Well, I hope that some people who are working on the Syria problem listen to this. Something about the leadership changes and who can be a good leader and who doesn't, probably all completely applicable to the situations there too.
Yes.
All right. Well, first, thank you very, very much. That's just a great, great story that you have. And second, we'll open it up to questions from the audience.
And I will bring around the microphone as we always do, because we do record everything. So let's
get the questions in.
Hi.
Hi.
Really enjoyed this. Thank you. Thinking about Nama and Jackie and memory and what your observations might be about were around the traumatic memory, recurring memories that might have been at play even, you know, once they transcended what they did.
I think, you know, some of the chimpanzees, it's a similar question in humans. What causes some humans to be resilient and be able to survive emotionally the most horrendous experiences and others don't? And, you know, they just, you know, descend into misery. And I think with chimpanzees, I've seen the same difference. I mean, Nama was this amazingly resilient chimpanzee, and so was Jackie. And, you know, the stereotypy that Jackie had, where he would, you know, beat the top of his head and all kinds of really disturbing things. When he got to the sanctuary within a couple of months, that had stopped completely, and he's never done it again. And he had been doing it for years. But we do have other chimpanzees there who've shown. Now, does he remember what happened to him? I would guess. I mean, they do. If they get mad at you, if there's somebody they don't like, they cannot see you for 10 years and they're going to see you and still hate you. So not all of them hold grudges and they're open to reconciliation. I mean, I've found they usually are. But if you don't reconcile and you've done something wrong, they're going to remember it. So they can remember that. And so I don't know how much he thinks about what he experienced, but he certainly remembers it. But we do have other chimpanzees who, you know, had stereotypy when we brought them and they still have it. So not everybody is as resilient.
Would you be willing to guess what the future of your enclosure is going to be and the fate of the chimpanzee and the gorilla in the Cameroons?
Well, if patterns don't change in Cameroon, they are going to be extinct probably in my lifetime. If not my lifetime, my daughter's lifetime. And if you think about it, in 1900, there was an estimated between 1 million and 2 million chimpanzees on the continent of Africa. Today, there's maybe 150,000 left in all the countries. And if you think about 1900 to now, the change and what has evolved over 5 million years, it was the geographical speck, and they've just plummeted. And that isn't changing enough right now to change the course. They are headed toward extinction if things don't change. So that's the grim news. But in terms of the chimpanzees at our sanctuary, I am committed to them for the rest of my life, and I have some great people working with me, and we're working on, you know, sustainable management plans so that we're sure they're going to be cared for as long as they live. We also are collaborating with two other organizations and the government of Cameroon in looking for a site where we might actually be able to release some of them to do a reintroduction into the wild. But it's very difficult for chimpanzees once they've been taken captive. The path back is not easy. It's very dangerous, and the criteria are steep to find a location that would fit our needs. But so some of our chimpanzees may one day be reintroduced. I'm not sure that's going to happen. But all of them are going to at least be able to live out their lives at Sanagyong. And I hope we're going to change the pattern of things in Africa, and chimpanzees are going to survive. But
thank you so much for your work and compassion. I didn't understand the family you talked about who said those are our animals, and yet you took them away. I don't see how they owned them. And another thing, I just have a feeling that we have so little knowledge of the knowledge and sentience. We often say, oh, they're not sentient creatures. I think so many more are. And I'm wondering, you know, how that's progressing about our knowledge of animals having sentience. And another thing, I'm a vegetarian too, and because we have the awareness we have, and I think compassion is native to us, although some people have kind of lost it, I kind of think it's almost not very moral, knowing that there's so much food on the planet that we don't need to eat animals, that it's really bad for the environment, they suffer a lot, they're killed, that in a way you could even say it's not entirely moral and it's not necessary.
So the last was a comment. And then the first two about the family, they, you know, in the organization In Defense of Animals, doesn't think anybody can own any animal, and they, rather than saying animal owners, the organization is promoting the concept of animal guardianship instead. But this family thought that they owned the chimps the way one might own a dog. It was completely illegal for them to have them there, though. To hold chimpanzees captive was illegal, but there was just no enforcement of the law. So they were like, you are taking my chimpanzees that I own. And so that was their idea about it. But they didn't own them, and they were holding them illegally. And so then in terms of the idea of sentience, I think, you know, certainly I think a lot of species are sentient. And I think I had been gone for so long. Now I'm splitting my time between Africa and Cameroon for the last couple of years, but I lived there for 13 years, and I was really cut off from what people were thinking outside. And so I was really surprised that people had seen the picture of Dorothy's funeral and recognized the grief in the faces of the chimpanzees. And I'm not sure that 10 years ago people would have done that. I don't know. But I hope there's an evolution and that we, you know, and our ability to recognize that, you know, that it is an evolutionary process. Our brains are not that different. The seat of emotion is the amygdala. And it's about the same size as in chimpanzees as it is in humans. The cerebral cortex is bigger in humans. And so our experience of emotions and how we think about it is going to be somewhat different. But it is an evolutionary process. And the chimpanzees certainly are sentient. And, you know, they certainly experience complex emotions, as do other mammals as well. I mean, all mammals have complex limbic systems. And even crocodiles experience the emotion of fear. Reptiles have amygdalas as well. I just hoped he didn't have a brain to think about it very much.
Yeah. I wonder if we could see that film that she started to show. That, that's
I'm going to go through questions first, and then we'll try to set that up when the hour is over. How about that? And we can try to set the film up, because mm-hmm. it might take some time to get it going.
I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about your experience treating the chimpanzees medically, as a medical person.
Well, you know, I was a veterinarian working on dogs and cats primarily, and when I started working on chimpanzees, I was really on the steep end of the learning curve because, you know, they're much more like humans than they are like any other animals. But my surgical skills were transferable. I just had to learn the anatomy. And the other thing I had to learn was the tropical diseases, which was tropical medicine is really different than medicine in the temperate world. So I had to learn all that. And I, you know, I had books and I had colleagues that I was able to consult with. Once after 2002, we had a phone access in the nearest town. Before that, we were completely cut off. So basically, you know, I taught myself on the job because there was nobody else. And I had in the book, I write about some incidents of providing care. But chimpanzees, you know, like humans, they can tell you what hurts. And even domestic animals, chimpanzees cannot. I misspoke. Humans can tell us. Chimpanzees cannot. They don't have the words to express it. And a cat or a dog, I can go in and touch them, and they might wince if they touch something that hurts. And a chimpanzee, they're very stoic and they don't show pain very easily. And if they're in the forest, you know, I may not be able to do. Some of them will come up if they hurt. Now, this is one of the things they do. If they have something that hurts, a lot of times they come up and show me. If they've got a wound, they come and show me and they want me to do something with it. You know, if they'll let me, you know, they want help when they're sick. And so, you know, a lot of times I can treat that way. But if it's a chimpanzee who doesn't want me to touch them, I can't recall one actually doing that, no. But they'll come up where I can touch them and I can see pain on their faces. And then I can reach my hand in and touch. And then if I touch their bellies, they can tense their belly and I'll know, oh, that's where it hurts. So it can be clear that way. But mostly I think one of the things that people, you know, don't really recognize is the degree to which they cooperate. And a lot of places that work with chimpanzees in captivities and in biomedical laboratories and even in zoos, they have all these ways for training their chimpanzees to come up and show their foot or to show their hand or so that when they're injured, they can look at things. But there's no problem with our chimpanzees. I mean, we have the relationships between us that if, you know, we're friends and if they have something that hurts, they want to see if I can help with it. Yeah. And asking for help.
I have to say, having read the book, that was very modest. There's a tremendous story about the surgery that you performed with help from a colleague back in Oregon, which was really fascinating. I will take up the time telling the story.
Well, first of all, you're amazing.
Thank you.
I have to say that this is just wonderful. What about mating? I mean, like in zoos that are not having the animals reproduce, they allow mating behavior, but they use medication to stop it. What are you saying these animals will be there for their lifetime and taken care of? What are you doing about mating?
We use, when I first brought the chimps there, and now the whole idea of having babies in there, it really enriches their lives. It's good for the group. I wish they could have babies, and I feel the loss that they can't. But there's a lot of reasons why they can't. And, you know, we have limited resources. Chimpanzees live to be 55, 60 years old. We need to save this space for orphans. Females who don't have their own babies will sometimes adopt orphans, but once they have their own kids, forget it. They're not going to adopt. And then ultimately, even though I don't think anywhere on the planet do chimpanzees have a better captive life than what they have with us. But they are still not self-determining. They still rely on us for their food. And no matter how good it is, I don't think a chimpanzee should be born to a life of captivity. And so we just, we don't allow breeding. And what I do, though, before I would vasectomize the males, because chimpanzees are too self-conscious to be castrated. I would never castrate them. But just like they do, I actually learned from a human surgery book. I got a human surgery book and learned how to do the vasectomies. And so I vasectomized them until we started seriously considering reintroduction. And at that point, I would want them to be able to reproduce. So then I wasn't sure who would be candidates for reintroduction. So I stopped doing vasectomies, and now we use birth control pills and then in the females. And then some we've given implants, so either implants or birth control pills.
Next question. Who else has a question?
It sounds like you bonded with a lot of them, but do you generally feel safe around the others, like the mean ones that you described?
I think that really it depends on the circumstances. And, you know, I know the chimpanzees well enough to read them, and I don't, I don't approach a chimpanzee during a display, for example. I know to stay back. But there are certain circumstances, like if a chimpanzee wants to groom me and he's showing all the signs of wanting to groom, which chimpanzees generally move their mouths when they want to groom, like, and if it's their mouths will tense up like they're concentrating. And if I see a chimpanzee looking at my hairline and doing that, he's coming to me in peace, so I have no problem with approaching him. So I have to know when to approach them. Of the chimpanzees, we have 73, and there is one of those 73, a female, who just is holding a grudge against me for a long time. I I anesthetized her, and I had I crawled up on the satellite cage to hand inject her. I had given her something to make her sleepy by mouth, and I crawled up to hand inject her, and she woke up and came face to face to me with that syringe in my hand, and I fell back off the cage, which was like 2 meters up, and I didn't reconcile right away. I didn't have a lot of time. I had to leave the next day. It was fine. I did what I had to do, and I left. But ever since then, she absolutely hates me, and I've never been able to bridge the gap and make a friend of her. And one day I still hope to, but mostly I wouldn't want to meet her on a trail.
I'd just like to introduce Dr. Elliot Katz right here. He's the founder and president emeritus of In Defense of Animals, and I'd like to ask him a question. Elliot, what did you think when Sherry said, I want to go there and form a sanctuary?
Very, very, very pleased. I have that same connection with other species as Sherry does. And when she told me about the situation over there and what she experienced seeing the three chimpanzees in their cages, it was tearing out my heart too. So I was pleased to see her go, because there's always this competition between us anyway. So is that enough, Sherry?
Thank you.
Any other questions?
You mentioned vasectomies and implants. What are implants? And in the vasectomy, something's tied, right? And
yeah.
Also, are gorillas about to go extinct?
Yeah, in the vasectomy, it's just like it's the duct that carries the sperm from the testicle out. That it's the same thing they do in human males. And so I tied that so they didn't know anything had happened. I mean, they could see that they had little wounds, I'm sure, but... And they still continued their mating behavior just like before. So that's what a vasectomy is. And an implant, it's the same implants that they were created for humans. They're human implants, and they don't. I think they're used to some extent in the United States, but certainly in some countries in the world they're used a lot. And they're just implanted under the skin for 3 years, and they prevent pregnancy. Yeah, yeah. And the gorillas are in danger of extinction, yes, and they're about as critically endangered as chimpanzees are. They're about the same in terms of their numbers.
Is there a certain person or several people working on helping them?
There are. My organization is a founding member of an organization called Pan-African Sanctuary Alliance, and we have, I think there's 20 of us now. And some of them have chimpanzees at their sanctuaries. I've chosen not to have, because there's another facility in Cameroon that's run by a good friend of mine, and she takes gorillas, and we work together on conservation issues all the time.
Could you talk a little bit about your outreach and education activities to the community around you and how they've responded to that?
Yes, we've done... we've really impacted the community a lot. When I went there, I realized there was no way we could go into a community that, as impoverished as that one, with so much need, and focus only on chimpanzee conservation and not do anything to improve the lives of the people. And so we focused on that. We've provided jobs to people who never had jobs before. And we buy our fruits from the villages. And so these farmers grow fruits just for us. And we go into the villages 3 times a week. And so we created a market economy where none existed before. And going into the villages, that gives us continual opportunities to engage and talk about conservation. We also have built a school in the village of Mayenne. There was no school there. There was a government school, but there was no building, and there was no books. And so we started, when I first went there, we started buying the books, and they had their school just under a raffia roof with no walls. And so then the Dutch embassy gave us money in 2008, and we constructed a school. And then we've recently put in a grain mill in another village. And so because we've impacted that community and improved their lives, the people in that direct community are supportive of our mission. And then we've reached out to the country at large. We had a radio campaign that ran for 3 years. We produced 6 radio spots in 3 different languages, French and then 2 of the local languages. And those were broadcast thousands of times. And I think that we definitely succeeded in letting people know that chimpanzees are endangered and that they could go to jail. I don't think anybody left in the country doesn't know that now. I don't know that we really changed behavior, but that takes time. But those are the things that we've done.
I thought it was very clever how you got the chieftain to make his whole section. Everybody, all of the lower chiefs had to listen to him. And
yes.
You got him to do one of the first things against the chimpanzees. Well, there's time for one more question.
Thanks very much for your presentation. It's fascinating. I'm curious, in the years that you've been going to Africa and Cameroon particularly, have you seen any impacts other than, you know, a decrease in poaching or hunting? I mean, is climate change real? Are you seeing it happening there? And is it impacting the chimpanzee population?
You know, the weather, I can't say whether that actually is impacting the chimpanzee population yet. The weather is bizarre right now. I mean, it's, we have, you know, we have two seasons in Cameroon, mud and dirt. And so, I mean, the temperature doesn't change that much, but it's either raining or it's not raining. And now we're having rain in the dry season and, you know, long periods of drought in the rainy season. So, you know, people talk about, you know, how unusual it is and, you know, whether it's just a fluke and that happens from time to time or whether it's due to the warming, I don't really know. But that's what we're seeing in that regard. And I will say in Cameroon, I mean, we're still seeing hunting and we've got a long way to go. But what we don't see anymore, when I went there, you saw chimpanzees held in open establishments. And you don't see that anymore. And that's not that they're not still being orphaned, and it's not that private people aren't holding them inside their compounds, but they're not held publicly anymore.
It's a great accomplishment. And I want to really thank Sherry for coming and sharing this story with us. Thank you very much. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year of history of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.